Geffen Ashram. Part one of the Gaon centers on, roughly you could say, six themes. The importance of detachment in attaining to true understanding of God and His prophets. An account of the cruelty suffered by the divine messengers. The consequences of man blindly following religious leaders and not searching out truth for themselves. The exalted station of the manifestations of God. The method of God in trying His servants to distinguish the sincere from the false. And finally, the relativity of religious truth as well as the continuity of divine revelation. Major themes covered in the first part of the book. Some of these themes continue to appear in the second part as well. In the first class, we mentioned, it was on your sheet here, that it would be helpful to prepare a subject outline of the text. I don't know if any of you have been working on such an outline. It's a challenge. There are many different ways that it could be done. This is one attempt of mine that's kind of been refined, giving this course a number of times here at the World Center. It's sequential, and it just is a kind of a way of highlighting the themes, the different themes, as you find them in the course of the first 100 pages here. Again, you'll see that some of these repeat the themes that I told you about earlier. Detachment being the key to true understanding. Then this marvelous passage about they that tread the path of faith, the prerequisites, the first mention of the prerequisites of those who would seek the Beloved, how to attain to knowledge of God. Words and deeds of men are no standard for understanding the recognition of God and His prophets. And then a consideration of the cause of denial of the prophets of the past. Accounts of cruelty suffered by the prophets of the past. Denials of religious leaders. The unfoldment of mysteries of verses. The coming and return of prophets. The distinction, variation, and unity of the prophets. Explanations regarding food and bread. And then a major theme, the major explanation of the first part, which is an explanation of the various aspects of the verses from the 24th chapter of Matthew, verses 29 to 31. There's two long sections on that. And within that are references to the meaning of various symbolic terms. You remember we saw that one of the overall themes of the Gaon was the interpretation of symbolic terms found in the scriptures. So there's reference here to sun and to moon, to the cleaving of heaven, changing of the earth. And a bit farther down, the meaning of coming in clouds, the meaning of clouds, of smoke, of angels, so on. On the backside, at the top, going back up, we see the purpose of symbolic terms is to test and prove people that the sincere might be known from the false. An explanation of the ways of the manifestation being contrary to the desires of men. Certain key passages which are as if adornments or accents in the theme of the book. You'll find, as you've probably seen, where Baha'u'llah will be going on with an explanation, and he'll stop and he'll say, "Oh, affectionate seeker," or "Oh, my brother." And he'll lift the whole argument out of this question of the interpretation of past prophecies and say something about the hour in which he's speaking, the moment a tremendous dramatic spiritual moment that Baha'u'llah is involved in himself. Even though he has not proclaimed himself yet as the manifestation, it's clear from these texts that he is the source of this inspiration. The position of the divines is described on page 80, and then the objections and differences that persist in every age. Finally, there's a discussion of the alleged corruption of the texts. The everlasting morn is breaking 3 degrees of perception of truth. The exhortation to the people of the Bayan at the end of the first section. So this covers 100 pages. We're going to look at 50 of them today, as best we can. Now, if you've got the Quran with you, you'll notice on page 3, an invocation of Baha'u'llah. He says, "In the name of our Lord, the Exalted, the Most High." Perhaps you will recall in the readings yesterday, there was reference to, in Arabic, in one of the English readings, there were the phrases, "Ya Baha'u'llah Bha," and "Ya Aliyul Ala," in Carol Allen's reading. Do you recall that? Do you know what they refer to? Of course, one is a call to Baha'u'llah. The other is a call to the Bab, Ya Aliyul Ala. And this Aliyul Ala is the second line of the text here. And these are titles associated with the Bab. Shoghi Effendi has adapted those two verses and calls them the battle cry animating the heroes and heroines of the 10-year crusade. You'll find a reference in Messages to the Baha'i World, page 153, in his message, where he says, this is the battle cry of those that are going out to serve the cause and raise the standard of the faith. And again, this is because we have these twin manifestations of God, so we invoke the confirmations and blessings of both of them. For the Bab's day has not passed, but is blended together with Baha'u'llah, and the two of them guard over the destinies of our faith. In the very first line he says, "No man shall attain the shores of the ocean of true understanding except he be detached from all that is in heaven and on earth." The whole discussion of true understanding that comes here and in so many tablets of Baha'u'llah has to do with the perception of truth which is not simply informing oneself about the contents of the holy books, but attaining to the what is called, I think, in the prayers of the fast as the hidden gift. That is the spiritual dimension behind these words. This attainment on the part of man of this true understanding, of this spiritual insight, is one of the animating purposes of creation, as stated by Baha'u'llah. Those of you that know Persian, this is marifat or irfan. It's the kind of knowledge that we say, "I bear witness, O my God, that thou hast created me to know thee." It isn't that thou hast created me to be informed that you exist. It's to recognize you. It's to perceive you in some way. And Baha'u'llah has said that that perception consists in the recognition of the light of the names of God shining from the reality of the manifestation of God. In other words, attainment to the presence of the manifestation is attainment to the presence of God for the purposes of human creatures such as we are. This true understanding he oftentimes likens to the nature of light. And so the Sun of Truth, or the Sun of Divine Knowledge, is the source of that illumination. And he quotes from the Hadith of the past and says that knowledge is a light which God casteth into the heart of whomsoever he willeth. And again, we have an idea of knowledge as illumination rather than as information. It is information, but it's more than that. It has this other dimension of cognizance of clear, sure recognition of, if you will, certitude. The spiritual prerequisites in this case are, to attain to this, are detachment and sanctity of soul. You want to note in this the requirement of virtue. This is something that I think is not always clearly understood in our Western societies particularly, is that there is a degree or a whole universe of knowledge which is dependent on good actions. You will never see out of the eye of your heart if you don't attain to the requisite degree of purity, of sanctity, if you don't cleanse the mirror of the heart. We're told that we can't see these spiritual truths. They're shining on us all the time, but we're veiled from them. And so this has to be removed. So, sometimes you'll see people say, well, why should I really change my behavior so much? I'm a Baha'i and I love the faith, and isn't that enough? Why should I change the way I act? Why should I deny myself pleasures and things that I like? The reason is that by narrowing in your pleasures a little bit, by focusing them more on spiritual things, we're told that then the eye of the heart opens. This perception of these spiritual truths that are bathing the human reality, within which the human reality exists and grows and develops, that we'll have access to that in increasing degrees. If this sounds like mysticism, this is what it is. You know that Shoghi Effendi says that the heart of every religion is this mystic or spiritual relationship between the soul of man and its maker. And the way we've been made, the greatest satisfaction, the supreme and true happiness, is to attain to those degrees of knowledge. We may think, or people may be deluded, that there is some other source of happiness, but it's always ephemeral. It isn't lasting. It doesn't satisfy in the end. It leaves the drinker thirsty still. People, it's clear, differ in the degree of attainment of this understanding. And Abdu'l-Bahá in a tablet comments on the relative character of this. It changes within us from time to time. And certainly it's different within the different characters and hearts of the believers, wherever they might be. Abdu'l-Bahá comments, he says that no matter how high the soaring ones fly in the utmost degrees of knowledge and comprehension, no matter how near the worshippers of the one true God ascend towards the summits of certitude, they are but reading letters from the book of their own selves, reaching only to the brilliant unseen signs that are enshrined in the reality of their own beings, having been placed there by God Himself, and circling round the center of their own entities. Then he says that degrees which are beyond the realms of understanding of man shall never be perceived nor understood by them. It's as if the center of our perception is a point upon which is fixed the needle point of a compass. Now you can make a circle with that compass. You can make an increasingly larger circle. It can take in the universe, but the center of it's always going to be your own faculty of perception. You're not going to change. Your nature of understanding is not going to become the understanding of the manifestation nor the understanding of God. It remains at its created level, which is appropriate, and it should do so. But we should understand that there is a difference between that. Now, this is important perhaps because in various schools of the past, schools of thought of the past, the thought of many of the spiritual seekers was that there is a point at which one becomes at one with God to the degree that one is God. That there is a spirit, a universal spirit. It has been divided into all of us, and that spirit is God's spirit, and all of us are part of God's spirit. And if we just get very quiet and still, we will feel and we will know that we are God and that all things are God. Well, Baha'u'llah doesn't subscribe to that, and he points out how the prophets of God in the past have distinguished between God, who is sanctified above all comprehension and understanding, and the level of human beings, which is an ephemeral dependency on the light of the manifestations of God. You'll notice in this he talks about being detached from all that is in heaven and on earth. We mentioned this before. In this connection, there's a statement in the Persian Bayan of the Bab. In connection with desire for earthly rewards or heavenly treasures, and that these are improper motives for seeking God's good pleasure. He says, if thy gaze should be on paradise, and thou shouldst worship him while cherishing such a hope, thou wouldst make God's creation a partner with him, notwithstanding the fact that paradise is desired by men. It shouldn't be the principal motive. The motivation should be the love that we feel towards God, centered in the manifestation of God. And this is the reason that we seek to obey him and to attain his good pleasure. The last line of the opening paragraph in the firmament of the Bayan. The Bayan, as you know, is the title of two works of the Bab, the Persian Bayan and the Arabic Bayan. But it's good to bear in mind that this term refers in general to utterance or explanation, exposition. And that the Bab himself says that in the Persian Bayan, that the substance of this chapter, one of the chapters of the Bayan, is this, that all the writings of the point, of the Bab, are named Bayan. Everything is divine exposition. So you have to find out from the context if it seems that he's referring to the specific work of the Bayan, or if he's referring to divine revelation in general. Baha'u'llah confirms this in a verse that's found in some prayers and meditations. Page 285, he said, should anyone consider thy books, which thou didst name the Bayan, and ponder in his heart what hath been revealed therein, he would discover that each of these books announceth my revelation, and declareth my name, and testifieth to myself, and proclaimeth my cause, and my praise, and my rising, and the radiance of my glory. In line 3, we have the first mention of certitude. They that thirst for the wine of certitude. You know, this is the meaning of egon. And this theme is not found only here in the Kitab Egon itself, but in Baha'u'llah's other writings. There's just a few samples. He says, for example, blessed are they who on the wings of certitude have flown in the heavens which the pen of thy Lord the All-Merciful hath spread. Here we have another image of, just like the mirror capturing the light, you have the soul as a bird flying in the heavens of divine revelation, soaring through, observing the immensity of God's significances. And again he says, let's do this. He it is who hath unveiled to your eyes the treasuries of his knowledge and caused you to ascend unto the heaven of certitude, the certitude of his resistless, his irrefutable, and most exalted faith. Baha'u'llah himself, you'll recall, changed the title of this book to the Kitab-i-Egan during the Akka period, when he was here in the Holy Land. It had been known before that as the explanation for the uncle, Rasale Khal. And he changed it to, he said it should be now titled the Kitab-e-Igan, the Book of Certitude. So the title is from him, himself, in distinction to some of the other tablets that have been given names by usage rather than the fact that they were named that by Baha'u'llah. Well, I think he didn't state it as a reason, but it's clear that the book so transcends the questions of the uncle of Bab that it becomes a universal textbook and therefore is a book of certitude for all mankind.
I guess it's the same thing that I asked the separation beforehand.
Perhaps, yes, that's true too. Right. On the second page, we have this mention of not regarding the words and deeds of mortal men as a standard for the true understanding and recognition of God and His prophets. The true standard. What is the true standard then? In a number of places, he talks about it being the book itself. Principle of reference to the revealed word of God as the balance in determining the truth of things is most powerfully stated perhaps in the most holy book, in the Kitab-i Aqdas, where he says, "Weigh not the book of God with such standards and sciences as are current amongst you, for the book itself is the unerring balance established amongst men. In this most perfect balance, whatsoever the people and kindreds of the earth possess must be weighed, while the measure of its weight should be tested according to its own standard. Did ye but know it?" That's found in the synopsis on page 22. Do you have any thoughts on this, what we've discussed so far? Please, any questions or thoughts, comments? If you don't say something, I'll lose my voice. You have to help. I can see you. I hope nobody's saying, "Oh, I won't ask that question because it's too foolish." If you don't have any questions, that's fine. But if you do have, if you share them, probably other people have the same one. Thoughts? No? Page 4. Consider the past. Would someone read that paragraph for us? It's kind of nice. If you've got a loud voice and you think you can read over this. Some brave soul, please. The paragraph beginning, consider the past.
Consider the past.
Thank you.
How many, both high and low, have at all times yearningly awaited the advent of the manifestations of God in the sanctified persons of His chosen ones? How often have they expected His coming? How frequently have they prayed that the breeze of divine mercy might blow and the promised beauty step forth from behind the veil of concealment and be made manifest to all the world? And whensoever the portals of grace should open and the clouds of divine bounty did rain upon mankind, and the light of the unseen did shine above the horizon of celestial might, they all denied Him and turned away from His face, the face of God Himself. Refer ye to verify this truth, to that which hath been recorded in every sacred book."
Mm-hmm. Would you try the next paragraph too, and then we'll come in. Willing to go on, David, for another paragraph?
"Ponder for a moment and reflect upon that which has been the cause of such denial on the part of those who have searched with such earnestness and longing. Their attack has been more fierce than tongue or pen can describe. Not one single manifestation of holiness has appeared, but he was afflicted by the denial, the repudiation, and the vehement opposition thus it hath been revealed, O the misery of men. No messenger cometh unto them, but they laugh him to scorn. Again he saith, Each nation hath plotted darkly against their messenger to lay violent hold on him, and disputed with vain words to invalidate the truth.
This whole theme here about what happens to the manifestations of God when they appear is discussed now in a series, these cruelties of references to Noah, to Hud, to Saleh, to Abraham, to Moses, and to Jesus. Baha'u'llah makes a number of significant remarks about this. He calls upon us to examine the wondrous behavior of the prophets and recall the defamations and denials, this is bottom of page 5, uttered by the children of negation and falsehood. Perchance you may cause the bird of the human heart to wing its flight away from the abodes of heedlessness and doubt unto the nest of faith and certainty, and drink deep from the pure waters of ancient wisdom and partake of the fruit of the tree of divine knowledge. Such is the share of the pure in heart of the bread that hath descended from the realms of eternity and holiness. Should you acquaint yourself with the indignities heaped upon the prophets of God and apprehend the true causes of the objections voiced by their oppressors, you will surely appreciate the significance of their position. Then he talks about making mention of diverse accounts relative to the prophets, that these accounts may demonstrate the truth that throughout all ages and centuries the manifestations of power and glory have been subjected to such heinous cruelties that no pen dare describe them. And then he goes on, among the prophets was Noah. Now I've got some notes here in the meanwhile. On page 4, for the first time, he introduces the term manifestations of God. I don't know how early this term starts appearing in Baha'u'llah's writings, but this is the first reference to it in the Iqan. In another tablet, Baha'u'llah says, In the kingdom of earth and heaven, there must needs be manifested a being, an essence who shall act as a manifestation and vehicle for the transmission of the grace of the divinity itself. He says, through the teachings of this day star of truth, every man will advance and develop until he attaineth the stations at which he can manifest all the potential forces with which his inmost true self hath been endowed. The person of the manifestation hath ever been the representative and mouthpiece of God. He, in truth, is the dayspring of God's most excellent titles and the dawning place of his exalted attributes. These references are from the Gleanings, page 66 and 70. It's mentioned here that the words and deeds of the prophets, as set forth in this whole first section of the Iqan, have been the essential factors affecting the distinction between negation and affirmation. Those who conform to the Book of God, as explained by the Bab, will abide in paradise under the shadow of his affirmation, and those who deviate from it will be consigned to the fire and be assembled beneath the shadow of negation. With regard to the operation of this principle in his own day, Baha'u'llah affirms, If all who are in heaven and on earth be invested in this day with the powers and attributes destined for the letters of the Bayan, whose station is 10,000 times more glorious than that of the letters of the Quranic dispensation, and if they one and all should, swift as the twinkling of an eye, hesitate to recognize my revelation, they shall be accounted in the sight of God of those that have gone astray, and regarded as letters of negation. This is a tremendous test that comes to the people when the new manifestation appears. And Baha'u'llah says he's able to distinguish between the hearts of those who truly are attracted to God and those who have religion as a convenience or for their own vainglory. And the ones that are in the worst position in this respect are the divines, that is, the spiritual, so-called spiritual leaders of the past dispensation, who are enjoying a tremendous prestige and position in relation to the people because of their association with the religion of the previous manifestation. Now a new prophet of God comes and appears and announces himself. What is their position? Their position is gone. And they're put to severe test. And Baha'u'llah, in this first part of the Quran, condemns the divines, religious authorities, as the most grievous veil that keeps the people back from recognizing the new manifestation. And the whole thing has to go through a long process of attack and persecution and so on until this thing comes clear to the heart of those who are sincere in the first instance, and oftentimes they give their lives in the process, and then it moves out to others. Gradually the seeds of the faith are sown in new souls, and the springtime, the divine springtime, begins to appear in the world. Any questions about that up to now? Please. Compilation. You know, the Bab even makes a play on this numerical meaning of the word nar, which means fire. He says through his coming, the Bab's coming, and the numerical value of his name is 5. If you add 5 to the numerical value of nar, you come up with a numerical value of nur, which is the word for light. So you have nar, fire, and nur is light. And the coming of the Bab, the acceptance of the Bab is like the acceptance of the numerical system in that numerical interpretation of 5 points. And that raises you from nar to nur, so to speak. So it has a foundation even in the abjad interpretations. But that's a bit complicated. I think the whole point of it is that the revelation reveals the character of each of us. And if we respond to the light, if we respond to the energy or creative force of the revelation, it illumines us. If we negate it, it causes us to burn. The same energy produces negation and affirmation. If there were no challenge from the manifestation of God, there wouldn't be any negation either. It all comes. The whole drama is centered in the manifestation and how we respond to it. And in that sense, we have our daily battle between light and fire. You know, do we choose the fire? Do we choose the light? Do we choose what he wants? Do we choose what we want? How does it work? Then at the end of the day, you balance it up and find out where you stand. The balance it up, we already talked about, is the standard that Baha'u'llah has given us. He talks about the letters of negation. He says they must exist. You can find a further reference to letters of negation in Present Meditations on page 325. Baha'u'llah says, the letters of negation, no matter how far they may be removed from the holy fragrance of thy knowledge, and however forgetful they may become of the wondrous splendors of the dawning light of thy beauty, which are shed from the heaven of thy majesty must needs exist in thy realm, so that the words which affirm thee may thereby be exalted. And these words here may be taken also as understood to be those souls that affirm Baha'u'llah. That's an interesting point. We can't not progress spiritually because we're worried about, you know, not being vainglorious. Worse than that, we can't say that. You sometimes find that in our immaturity, in the administration, we'll say, well, we don't want to give so and so this task because it might make them proud. You'd leave that to God, you know. We all should do our part, and we should give everyone the opportunity, full opportunity they have to serve the cause. And then they have to work out within their own souls. I mean, we're not responsible for curing other people of their pride. God is perfectly capable of doing that. We want to give them their best opportunity, but we also want to do what He tells us. He calls on us. He commands us. Otherwise, what are we seeking? What kind of station? How could we ever achieve any of this? He calls on us to do it, and we submit. And we beg Him to help us to find the meaning of these things that He's exhorting us to. And the more we do that, the more we draw close to Him. The more we draw close to Him, the greater the intensity, the concentration of unity in the Baha'i community. So it really never becomes offensive to anybody if it's done in the right spirit. Now, if somebody's proud in another way, you know, that's the kind of knowledge that men pride themselves on, is this collected learning, this learning that he says here, we'll come to that next week, that men stealthily borrow the one from the other and pride themselves therein. Whereas this other spiritual knowledge requires a detachment from that kind of desire for vainglory or desire for position. That would be a veil immediately, which doesn't let the light of this thing shine in your being anyway. So it's self-defeating. So I think that as we seek the light, we trust that the light itself has this illumining, cleansing effect, if you will, on our motives. Not that our motives are ever entirely pure, but the illumination of this power reveals to us the baseness of our motives. And that doesn't make them attractive, so we tend to root them out. We don't like looking at them. If we draw close to the light, all of our defects and shortcomings become more marked. Now, if you hold pride, you won't go towards light. It's impossible. You don't mix together. It's too painful. So the soul turns back. The soul approaching the light, if it wavers in its devotion to the light, and it should turn back, if it's come close to God, as it turns back, it sees the immensity of its own shadow. How vast is the shadow? Because the ones that are drawing close to God have an influence behind them on others. Then they become fascinated with their own shadow. That's the end of that. So we want to pray that we be constant, we be steadfast. I think all this references to constancy and steadfast mean in our focus, in our direction, where we're aiming. That as we see our sights moving off of what they should be focused on, we beg for constancy, we beg for firmness. It's back to the covenant. He has promised to give us all of this grace and life if we conform ourselves to certain essential requirements, which will be the source of all of our happiness and development.
There's a good paragraph. He says,
it is, but as he goes on and points out what happened to all the prophets of God. You see, one of the questions, if you'll recall, that the Bab's uncle raised with Baha'u'llah is, how could the Qa'im, who is all powerful and supposed to be the Lord of the age and all, how could he be trampled under the feet of men? How could he be martyred and all? How could all these things happen to him? So just a minute. Can't you remember what happened to the other prophets? You know, he goes back and he reminds him, you know, he shows him that this is one of the signs of prophecy, that the prophets can bear these things, that they resign themselves to the sufferings of men, and that their immediate followers do the same thing. offer themselves up, demonstrating that this world means nothing to them. You know? Just kind of combine them. The Surah of Hud is a surah of, as you may know, of the Quran. It's the 11th chapter of the Quran, some 123 verses, and it recounts the successive calls of God's prophets to their peoples and the dire consequences that befall these people when they reject the manifestations of God. So he recounts that this prophet came and announced, he called the people unto God, and they laughed him to scorn. And then later a calamity befell them. And then after a time another prophet was raised up, and he spoke to the people and addressed their hearts and so on. And then that the calamity followed after they rejected him. So it's a series of this pattern of denial on the part of the people of the manifestation. If you find the Quran, you can look for it. Chapter 11. As for Hud himself, he's mentioned here in another context. He's the first of five prophets of God sent to the Arab peoples. The others are Saleh, Abraham, Shoaib, and Muhammad. He came to the people of Ad. We had just made reference here how Noah for 950 years was addressing the people and so on. There's a letter here from the Guardian about written on the Guardian's behalf. He says, the Guardian advises that the period of 950 years referred to in the Agan as the time Noah exhorted the people refers to the period of his ministry. The term year does not refer to a period of time such as our year. It was entirely different and thus does not extend over any such period as our present term year would imply. In other words, people will ask that, well, how is it possible that they lived 950 years? And he says, this is not the same time calculation. And again he says, approximately 6,000 years have elapsed since the appearance of Adam. The ages of the prophets specified in the Bible were based on a different calculation than the one used at present. The years mentioned in the Bible were different from ours. The Bible makes no reference to Noah at all until he's 500 years old, and then it says he begot three sons. Well, we won't have time to go into the details of the various prophetic sequences. Some mention should perhaps be made here to this divine promise that was not fulfilled. On page 7, he's talking about Noah, and long afterwards he several times promised victory to his companions and fixed the hour thereof. But when the hour struck, the divine promise was not fulfilled. This caused a few among the small number of his followers to turn away from him, and to this testify the records of the best known books. These you must certainly have perused, if not, undoubtedly you will. Finally, as stated in books and traditions, there remained with him only 40 or 72 of his followers. Now, Baha'u'llah doesn't resolve this difference and discrepancy. In one book, it says there were 40 followers. In another tradition, it says there were 72. So he puts both of these so that he doesn't enter into this controversy about which is the right tradition about this subject. See? Otherwise, people say, well, what do you mean 40 or 72? Couldn't he have said 40 or 50 or something like that? It's a specific reference to two traditions. Now, this divine promise is very interesting. The non-fulfillment of a prophetic announcement due to a change in the divine purpose. It's an accepted theological principle in Islam, and it's also confirmed in the Baha'i writings. It's called in the original Bada, the non-fulfillment of a prophetic announcement due to a change in the divine purpose. With regard to the specific promise that is mentioned here as having been made by Noah, on the various accounts of the Muslim traditions, it's related how God told Noah to inform his followers that after eating dates, they should plant the seeds, and that once these grew to fruition, divine punishment would descend on their enemies. The fresh fruits appeared, and Noah, when asked about the promised punishment, said that God wanted them to now plant the seeds of this new fruit. And when it bore dates, then the punishment would come. And as stated here, a few of his followers turned away at that stage. They didn't think that was a good enough proof. This is a test which was again later repeated to his followers. Even then, they had another round of it still, and it reduced still more the followers. Maybe that was the reason. In the Persian Bayan, the Bab explains the non-fulfillment of a divine promise is another expression of God's power to do whatsoever he willeth. No one can oppose this because his decree is just. Non-fulfillment when it concerns creation is related to weakness and limitation on the part of the creatures. But when it is attributed to God, it is evidence of his might and power. Yes. Yes. You know, I don't have a text for this, but I know that some of the pilgrims had come back. They'd asked the guardian about this, and he said there's no bada, there's no non-fulfillment connected with Baha'u'llah's words. This is the extraordinary character of this dispensation. Now, whether that's affirmed somewhere in a text or not, I've been trying to find out. Yes, but it wasn't a promise that there would be. It was understood that there could be. And there's a verse of the Akdas which says that the Aksan, if they end, you know, before the time of the House of Justice, which was exactly the case that happened. So there were indications in the text that such a thing could happen. We had two Aksan. We had Abdul Baha and Shoghi Effendi, and then it's finished. That's a curious thing. There was a... one of the specific mentions of Abdul Baha in his tablets, we don't have this translated, but one of the Persian shahs in Abdul Baha's time, he had hinted that he could become the just king mentioned by Baha'u'llah in the Akdas. And then he didn't. And Abdul Baha pointed out, this is one of those cases where it was weakness on the part of the creature that caused the non-fulfillment, not the promise of God. The promise of God was there. He could have been that promised king if he had responded to Abdul Baha correctly. But he didn't, so he lost the chance. Okay. Now, of these various episodes here, Shoghi Effendi has chosen one passage in particular that he's quoted in the Gleanings. We could read that now. It's on page 11. When his day was ended, there came the turn of Moses. Someone's got a good voice for reading, if you have a loud voice. If you would read this paragraph up to the top of the next page, to where it says, God's holy will and pleasure, line 3 and 4.
And when his day was ended, there came the servant Moses, armed with the rod of celestial dominion, adorned with the white hand of divine knowledge, and proceeding from the Quran of the love of God, and wielding the serpent's power and everlasting majesty, who shone forth from the Sinai of light upon the world. He summoned all the people who came to the earth to the kingdom of eternity, and invited them to partake of the fruit of the tree of faith. Surely you are aware of the fierce opposition of the Pharaoh and his people, and of the stone of idol fancy which the hands of the infidels cast upon that blessed tree, so much so that Pharaoh and his people finally arose and exerted their utmost endeavor to extinguish with the waters of falsehood and denial the fire of that sacred tree, oblivious of the truth that no earthly water can quench the flame of divine wisdom, nor mortal blast extinguish the lamp of their everlasting dominion. Nay, rather, such water cannot but intensify the burning of the flame, and such blast cannot but ensure the preservation of the land, for ye must serve with the eye of discernment, and walk in the way of God's only will and good.
And then the next paragraph, which is a summary, in a sense, of all of this, starting with the words, reflect, on page 13, reflect, what could have been the motive for such deeds? Can someone read that one for us? And he goes on to say that leaders of religion in every age have hindered their people from attaining the shores of eternal salvation, inasmuch as they held the reins of authority in their mighty grasp. Some for the lust of leadership, others through want of knowledge and understanding, have been the cause of the deprivation of the people. By their sanction and authority, every prophet of God hath drunk from the chalice of sacrifice and winged his flight under the heights of glory. What unspeakable cruelties they that have occupied the seats of authority and learning have inflicted upon the true monarchs of the world, those gems of divine virtue. Content with a transitory dominion, they have deprived themselves of an everlasting sovereignty. Thus their eyes beheld not the light of the countenance of the well-beloved, nor did their ears hearken unto the sweet melodies of the bird of desire. Well, there's many details here, friends, that we can't go into. The episode of the fire, the meaning of the she camel. There's so many things here. I don't know what kind of questions, if you've put down any questions that you particularly want to know something about in the course of the readings that you've been doing, you could ask them. The she camel is connected with the mission of Saleh, the second of these five prophets to the Arabs. He appeared to the Samud people, the Samudi people. And when Saleh was asked for a sign by the people who opposed him, God sent them a she-camel. This is according to the Quran. Abdu'l-Bahá explains that the she-camel mentioned in relation to Saleh's mission is a symbol of Saleh himself and the camel's offspring as being his blessed faith. In this sense, Baha'u'llah addresses one of his enemies, saying that because of him, the she-camel was hamstrung. The faith of God was bound or caught. This is in the Epistle to the Son of the Wolf, page 83. And again he says, the heedless ones have hamstrung thy white she-camel and cause thy crimson arc to founder. And again, in the same tone, he says, consider the she-camel, though but a beast, yet hath the All-Merciful exalted her to so high a station that the tongue of the earth made mention of her and celebrated her praise. All these references are from the Epistle to the Son of the Wolf. Saleh is, the prophet Saleh is traditionally known to be buried in Acca. Nabi-e Saleh, do you know that this is the resting place? It's on a little hill in the middle of the old Muslim cemetery. And it was next to that spot where the son of Baha'u'llah, Mirza Mehdi, and Nawab were buried before their transfer here to the mountain. He's yes, up on a hill there. Behind it, there's some fence, and there's still, I think there's still some other Baha'is buried there too. This is very interesting. I remember Riyah Hanum saying that Nabi means prophet, so Nabi Saleh, the resting place of Nabi Saleh means the resting place of the prophet Saleh. She said she was on a tour in the south years ago, in the south, in the Sinai, when the Sinai belonged to Israel. They made a trip down there, and the tour guide was driving through these desert vastness of mountains in these tremendous bald rocky mountains, and occasionally you'll see some little shrine, like little whitewashed little domed edifice of some sort. So they were driving by this one place, and he didn't mention anything about this. So someone had asked, "What is that?" And he said, "That's the resting place of Nabi Saleh." So Riha Khanna said, she said, "But I thought he was buried in Akka. His grave is in Akka." And the tour guide, very fast, he said, "This is his summer resting place." He mentions on page 11 about the expulsion of Abraham from his city. This refers to the Ur of Chaldees. And that exile is very important. It's mentioned in God Passes by Shoghi Effendi on page 107. It refers to the banishment of Abraham from Ur of Chaldees to the Promised Land as a banishment which in the multitudinous benefits it conferred upon so many diverse peoples, faiths, and nations constitutes the nearest historical approach to the incalculable blessings destined to be vouchsafed in this day and in future ages to the whole human race in direct consequence of the exile suffered by him whose cause is the flower and fruit of all previous revelations, referring to Baha'u'llah's exile as well. I've never seen any distinction made in that way, but certainly they appear here together with Noah and with Abraham and with Moses and with Christ, so one tends to see them at the same level. Certainly in the Quran they're seen as full prophets of God, but the records of their missions are for the most part lost, and the people that they address themselves to are lost as well. So they don't think of them with the same importance as the ones that still have followers, so to speak. Many, many prophets have appeared in the world with books, with teachings, and they've disappeared again. Everything's gone. Traces are all gone. Yes. They were before Moses, even. They were early on. Yes? Well, basically, the explanation, as I understand it from some answered questions, is that some of the prophets are dependent on others. These lesser prophets come to move the people forward within a dispensation that belongs to a greater prophet. In other words, the lesser prophets of the house of Israel didn't abrogate the Torah. They propagated it. They explained it, and they gave other prophecies. But they didn't bring a book, an independent new book. They didn't renew the law of God. And in that sense, they were under the shadow of these other manifestations. Although they were all full manifestations of God, they could have brought a book, but the mission that they were assigned by God was to do what they did. We don't know. certainly they weren't following any prophet at his time, as if he had come to, you know, carry the faith forward a little bit. They seem to be pagans. He's treated as a major prophet in the Quran, as far as I understand. But one has to look at all the quotations, and I don't know if there's anything in the Baha'i writings about it. But he's treated as a major prophet. The nine that the Baha'i faith refers to are those nine existing major religions that still have followers. So you see, Noah's followers have all disappeared. Noah and his followers are gone. So we don't have that in the list of the nine. That's why. But there are still Sabians, for example, although they don't know who their prophet was. It's so long ago, it's presumed it must have been Enoch, but it's not clear. That's it. And we have to be careful of stating that. It doesn't mean that there were only nine religions. It means that this is the ninth of the existing religions that exist in the world at this time, the faith.
So the future manifestations that will be under the shadow of Baha'u'llah's guidance, will they come with a book?
We may have lesser manifestations, but there's no hint about that at all. But we will have a series of major manifestations of God appearing for 500,000 years, each of which will bring a book and abrogate the laws of the Akdas. This is mentioned in letters of Shoghi Effendi. They will still be under the shadow of the Baha'i cycle. You see, the whole thing has been lifted up to another kind of comparison. It's not like the Adamic cycle. It's another cycle. It's the cycle of fulfillment. And they will be lord over their period, but Baha'u'llah is lord over the whole cycle, so to speak. Adam in the Quran is a major prophet, as far as what I can figure out. No. Mentioned as the nine religions? No. No. And Christians certainly don't think of him as a prophet at all. In this, we have to take the authority of the Quran and not the Bible. If there's a discrepancy between the position of a manifestation in the Quran and the Bible, we would hold to the Quran. It's more recent, it's more authenticated. For instance, Solomon is the full messenger of God in the Quran, King Solomon. But in the Bible, he's viewed in a very different way. The records have been distorted and things have changed and so on. Because he was the prophet of God that opened a new cycle of prophecy. And the records of the times before him, the religious records anyway, of the times before him are lost and obscured. So our recorded religious history goes back that far in this universal cycle that we're a part of. Yes, as a full prophet of God, yes. Did you want to ask something? What do we? Did you want to ask something?
Yes.
Please.
How do you understand this? At that time, the Lord shall descend from
heaven and
give
permission
to live with
the people. That's a good question. I take that to, in the same way as the prophecies of the Quran, to come to something here in a section called Attainment to the Divine Presence. So it was a promise that the people would attain to the presence of God in the last day, in the day of judgment. The Lord would come himself. In the prophecies in the Bible, it refers to the Lord as the vineyard. Remember, he sent his son, and then his son was killed, and then he came himself, and he established his rule. Baha'u'llah explains here in the Igan that the prophets of God appear and speak from different levels of authority. And one of the permissible levels of authority, but one from which the prophets rarely speak, is the statement, I am God. I am God himself. And he says that they are able to do this because in that state where they say that, they have so self-effaced themselves that really God is speaking through them in the first person to us. In other words, there's no way that God speaks to us except through the manifestations. And he says through the manifestations, I'm God, and I've come to give you my book, and here are my teachings. So in that sense, you can say that the prophet of God is God. At least the voice that's speaking from him is God. So if you say the Lord will come and sit and establish himself amongst them, this is, I think it has the same kind of meaning as that. But you must remember there's always an essence of God, there's a supreme essence, the invisible of invisibles that's beyond all understanding. And even Baha'u'llah testifies to his own lack of capacity to comprehend and penetrate this essence. Though on the one hand, he is that essence with regard to the worlds of creation. He's the face of God amongst men, as you said. Yes, very much so. Can you imagine when we all become manifestations of the will of God, when we conform our lives to, in a much greater degree, to the perfections that God has in store for us? What dissociation, what society will be like? What dissociation of the souls, one with another, will be like? I mean, if we enjoy so much now getting together, what will it be like then? What excitement will be caused by the gathering of the loved ones of God? And it's these degrees of spiritual fellowship and unity that Baha'u'llah has come to establish, unveil amongst the human race. And the whole human race comes under the shadow of his sovereignty. What will we have then? This is the kingdom of God on earth. The kingdom of God, in a sense, is that is made up of those subjects which submit themselves to the rule of the king. The king, in this sense, being God. So the people submit themselves to God's rule, and he rules through them. And his rule is a live rule. It isn't a book that's left behind. It's something that's alive even through the whole dispensation with the House of Justice. It's something that's never been seen on the face of the earth before. In the fourth Tajali of the Tajaliyat, the Tablet Tajaliyat, Baha'u'llah explains that the Bab has said in his writings that whatever he's done, and in the Akhtas he also explains this, he says that my forerunner has revealed laws and ordinances so that in this revelation the manifestation of God would speak forth only from the station of, and then he quotes, "Verily, verily, I am God, and there is none other God beside me." That he shouldn't have to deal with making ordinances about how often you need to bathe or what you need to do or what we need, because this is not his station. This station of Baha'u'llah is something so sublime. But Baha'u'llah says, out of my bounty, I've commented on these laws and revised some of the ones that the Bab gave and given you new ones and mitigated the severity of some of the past laws, canceled the ones that I felt in my heart were too much for you. But his purpose really is to speak always from this station. And the Akhtas is very strong in this, you know, that God is speaking to people through the Akhtas. It's a challenge. It's a challenging book from that point of view. And all of us need to understand this, the way of prophecy. Now we have the example of Christ, but it's kind of gotten confused. I and the Father are one, you know. This idea that mutual identity of Christ and the Father. But Baha'u'llah has explained it more subtly. So we can see we still see the truth in, but we see it in a new way in the biblical example of these things. Now Muhammad stressed the other. There's these two extremes. Christ stressed this closeness, identity of the manifestation in God. Muhammad said, I am but an apostle. I'm a man like the rest of you. I just give the book. The book is the important thing, not me. The book is the important thing. But that's the other pole of the same reality. It's too extreme the other way then. Then Baha'u'llah, the Bab and Baha'u'llah have come back to the supreme center of this thing. Well, we're not getting through 50 pages in an evening. But this is supposed to kind of, you know, be full of little tidbits and keep you all enthusiastic to keep reading and delving into these various points. Just to finish, on page 34, the middle of the page, Let's go to the top of the page. Thus it is that through the rise of these luminaries of God, the world is made new. The waters of everlasting life stream forth, the billows of loving kindness surge, the clouds of grace are gathered, and the breeze of bounty bloweth upon all created things. It is the warmth that these luminaries of God generate, and the undying fires they kindle, which cause the light of the love of God to burn fiercely in the heart of humanity. It is through the abundant grace of these symbols of detachment that the spirit of life everlasting is breathed into the bodies of the dead. Assuredly, the visible sun is but a sign of the splendor of that day star of truth, that sun which can never have a peer, a likeness, or rival. Through him, all things live, move, and have their being. Through his grace, they are made manifest, and unto him they all return. From him, all things have sprung, and under the treasuries of his revelation, they all have repaired. From him all created things did proceed, and to the depositories of his law they did revert. Now, if in these next, we're going to cover the next 50 pages in the next class. If you have any questions in that, or particular things that you want to bring up, please come prepared. That would be good. Part 2 is to be found in the Gleanings, section 13. If you wanted a series of extracts that would give the sense of part 1 of the first half of the Agon, you might turn to that compilation that Shoghi Effendi prepared. This has 1, 2, 3, 4... 5, 6, 7 passages that he's collected under the 13th heading in the Gleanings. Now, among the themes that we were talking about last week is that of the divine tests. On page 8 of the Agon, we read, "From time immemorial, even unto eternity, the Almighty hath tried and will continue to try his servants, so that light may be distinguished from darkness, truth from falsehood, right from wrong, guidance from error, happiness from misery, and roses from thorns. Even as he hath revealed, do men think, when they say, 'We believe,' they shall be let alone and not be put to proof." There's several other passages in this first part which give us the sense of what Baha'u'llah is trying to say. He says, "Were men to meditate upon the lives of the prophets of old, so easily would they come to know and understand the ways of these prophets that they would cease to be veiled by such deeds and words." Thank you. "As are contrary to their own worldly desires." This is from page 53. And again, page 57. "As thou comest to comprehend the essence of these divine mysteries, thou wilt grasp the purpose of God, the divine charmer, the best beloved. Thou wilt regard the words and the deeds of that Almighty Sovereign as one and the same, in such wise that whatsoever thou dost behold in his deeds, the same wilt thou find in his sayings. And whatsoever thou dost read in his sayings, thou wilt recognize in his deeds. Thus it is that outwardly such deeds and words are the fire of vengeance under the wicked, and inwardly the waters of mercy under the righteous. Were the eye of the heart to open, it would surely perceive that the words revealed from the heaven of the will of God are at one with and the same as the deeds that have emanated from the kingdom of divine power. Now, with regard to the words, he says on page 49, "Know verily that the purpose underlying all these symbolic terms and abstruse allusions, which emanate from the revealers of God's holy cause, hath been to test and prove the peoples of the world, that thereby the earth of the pure and illuminated hearts may be known from the perishable and barren soil. From time immemorial, such hath been the way of God amidst his creatures, and to this testify the records of the sacred books." And one of the examples of this test by means of words is the example of Noah that we read of last week. He several times promised victory to his companions and fixed the hour thereof. This caused a few among the small number of his followers to turn away from him. Then Baha'u'llah gives several examples of deeds or acts from God that have been also given as tests. He says, "The appearance," this is page 72, "the appearance of that immortal beauty in the image of mortal man, with such human limitations as eating and drinking, poverty and riches, glory and abasement, sleeping and waking, and such other things as cast doubt in the minds of men and cause them to turn away." Again, he says, "Other prophets similarly have been subject to poverty and afflictions, to hunger and to the ills and chances of the world. As these holy persons were subject to such needs and wants, the people were consequently lost in the wilds of misgivings and doubts, and were afflicted with bewilderment and perplexity." He gives some examples of things that happened also. This is one of the great veils. He talks about the clouds, the manifestation coming in clouds, and says that the clouds are these very, the very earthly frame that the manifestation appears in, a body like the rest of us have. And all this subjection to having to rest and eat and take care of himself that we have, apparently. Moses, he says, "Consider how," this is page 55, "consider how he hath suddenly chosen from among his servants and entrusted with the exalted mission of divine guidance him who was known as guilty of homicide, who himself had acknowledged his cruelty, and who for well nigh 30 years had in the eyes of the world been reared in the home of Pharaoh and been nourished at his table. Was not God the omnipotent king able to withhold the hand of Moses from murder, so that manslaughter should not be attributed unto him, causing bewilderment and aversion among the people?" Now you remember this incident of Moses coming to the help of another man and slaying someone who was attacking him. In the case of Jesus, he said, the case of Jesus, he cites the condition of Mary. He says, "How could she claim that a babe whose father was unknown had been conceived of the Holy Ghost? And now meditate upon this most great convulsion, this grievous test. Notwithstanding all these things, God conferred upon that essence of the Spirit, who was known among the people as fatherless, the glory of prophethood, and made him his testimony unto all that are in heaven and on earth." Now, those of us that have been raised in Catholic tradition or in some of the Christian churches realize that Christianity glories in the fact that Christ was born of a virgin. But if such a thing happened down the street from us here, and this is not too far from Nazareth, and a young lady whose husband, they say, has never been with her, and she's now growing, her tummy is growing, and she's saying that the Holy Ghost has told me that this is from him for me. Now, what would the people in this neighborhood believe about that? And then the child is born, and then this child, it is obviously no father, or we don't know who the father is. The father says he's not the father. This boy now says, "I'm the Son of God, and I've come to give you a message from God." this is only those people that have purity of heart and can see the spirit in this thing are going to be able to pass such tests. He hasn't made it easy from that point of view. Now, what about Muhammad? He cites the example of the Qibla, the changing of the Qibla, the point of adoration. The voice of Gabriel was heard again. This is on page 50. The voice of Gabriel was heard again. This is Muhammad in the Quran. Turn thou thy face towards the sacred mosque. In the midst of that same prayer, Muhammad suddenly turned his face away from Jerusalem and turned toward the Kaaba. Now, Jerusalem had been the place that everyone addressed their prayers for centuries. You know? Even in Christianity, it didn't change. And the Jews continued to address their prayers towards it. Everyone had that as the natural point of reference, the holy city of Jerusalem. Now suddenly Muhammad, who is leading them in prayer there, he changes direction and faces someplace else, towards the center of the mosque, towards the Kaaba. Well, it's just the people that were in the middle of their prayers, you know, just happy to be going along with the traditions. He says that whereupon a profound dismay seized suddenly the companions of the Prophet. Their faith was shaken severely. So great was their alarm that many of them, discontinuing their prayer, apostatized their faith. Verily, God caused not this turmoil, but to test and prove His servants. Otherwise, He, the ideal King, could easily have left the Qibla unchanged and could have caused Jerusalem to remain the point of adoration. Now this took place, and the historical setting of it is that it took place because of the Jews. Some of them had pledged allegiance to Muhammad, and then they were known as the hypocrites in Medina. They had turned away afterwards, or they plotted against him. And this displeased God, so He said, let us change this. Jerusalem, make another point of prayer. The Kaaba is a cube building in the center of the sacred mosque in Mecca. And that's the point around which circle the believers when they go on pilgrimage, the Muslim believers. You know, in Islam, at the beginning we heard that Baha'u'llah said the voice of Gabriel was heard again. Gabriel is the archangel considered in Islam as the mediator of revelation to Muhammad. And he's the personification of the divine spirit to him. If you look in God Passes By on page 100, you'll see a whole list of these various personifications of the Holy Spirit to the different prophets, like the burning bush to Moses and the sacred fire to Zoroaster, the dove to Christ, the angel Gabriel to Muhammad. What about Baha'u'llah? What was the symbol of the Holy Spirit to Baha'u'llah?
Maid of Heaven.
The Maid of Heaven that addressed him in the Siyat Chal. No, it was the Maid of Heaven. Mm-hmm. And what about the Bab? More difficult question. He had a dream. And what happened in the dream? Hossein. Yeah. Yes, he saw Hossein, the head of Hossein, hanging from a tree, and he went and he tasted of the blood that was dripping from it, and then that was transformed. That was the beginning of his prophetic mission. Which is very interesting because of the claim of Baha'u'llah to be the return of the Imam Hussein. The most great manifestation ever to appear in religious history claims to be the return of the third Imam of Muhammad. It's quite a distinction for the Imam Hussein. And his name is Baha'u'llah's own name was Hussein Ali. Yes?
Can you give us some references?
Yes. About this dream?
Yeah.
You can read about it in the Dawnbreakers, but I don't have the page number here. I believe it's in the footnotes, though, isn't it? I don't know. Have you read it in a shorter Dawnbreakers or in the American, the long, long edition? Can't. It's also referenced in God Passes By, too. So there's a reference in God Passes By? Okay. Good. Now, on page 52 again, Baha'u'llah says, such things take place only that the souls of men may develop and be delivered from the prison cage of self and desire. That the true should be known from the false and the sun from the shadow, he hath therefore in every season sent down upon mankind the showers of tests from his realm of glory. So this is one of these major themes that's discussed there. Well, have you been reading, continuing to read the text? I find that if we want to travel at the pace of ...50 pages a time, that really we're just skimming the surface. So if no one has to run off at the end of the course very soon, we might have that take something like 25 pages a class. A little more digestible portion. And then we'll see how far that takes us, probably into the end of June or something. There, we're going to go back a little bit because one of the major passages about the unity of the manifestations is on page 20 and 21. The bottom of page 20. We read that Baha'u'llah cites the reference from Christianity, from John 14. This is verse 28 and again verses 16 and 18 in the second verse. He says, to them that are endowed with understanding, it is clear and manifest that when the fire of the love of Jesus consumed the veils of Jewish limitations and his authority was made apparent and partially enforced, he, the revealer of the unseen beauty, addressing one day his disciples, referred unto his passing, and kindling in their hearts the fire of bereavement, said unto them, I go away and come again unto you. And in another place he said, I go and another will come, who will tell you all that I have not told you, and will fulfill all that I have said. Both these sayings have but one meaning, were you to ponder upon the manifestations of the unity of God with divine insight. Each of the manifestations manifests the unity of God, the oneness of God. Every discerning observer will recognize that in the dispensation of the Quran, both the book and the cause of Jesus were confirmed. As to the matter of names, Muhammad himself declared, I am Jesus. He recognized the truth of the signs, prophecies, and words of Jesus and testified that they were all of God. In this sense, neither the person of Jesus nor his writings hath differed from that of Muhammad and of his holy book, inasmuch as both have championed the cause of God, uttered his praise, and revealed his commandments. Thus it's said that Jesus himself declared, I go away and come again unto you. Consider the sun. Were it to say now, I am the sun of yesterday, it would speak the truth. And should it, bearing the sequence of time in mind, claim to be other than that sun, it would speak the truth. It still would speak the truth. In like manner, if it be said that all the days are but one and the same, it is correct and true. And if it be said with respect to their particular names and designations that they differ, that again is true. For though they are the same, yet one doth recognize in each a separate designation, a specific attribute, a particular character. Now the key, he says, conceive accordingly the distinction, variation, and unity characteristic of the various manifestations of holiness, that thou mayest comprehend the allusions made by the Creator of all names and attributes to the mysteries of distinction and unity, and discover the answer to thy question, this relates to one of the questions of the Bab's uncle, as to why that everlasting beauty should have at sundry times called himself by different names and titles. Now this is a prophecy from the Quran which really tells the people where the manifestation of God will appear. The boat of a piece is Darussalam, and Darussalam is one of the names, of traditional names of Baghdad. And he mentions here about this food. He says, we nourish your souls for the sake of God. We seek from you neither recompense nor thanks. This is the food that conferreth everlasting life upon the pure in heart and the illumined in spirit. This is the bread of which it is said, Lord, send down upon us thy bread from heaven. This bread shall never be withheld from them that deserve it, nor can it ever be exhausted. It groweth everlastingly from the tree of grace. It descendeth at all seasons from the heavens of justice and mercy. Down below he says, oh, the pity that man should deprive himself of this goodly gift, this imperishable bounty, this everlasting life. It behooveth him to prize this food that cometh from heaven, that perchance, through the wondrous favors of the Son of Truth, the dead may be brought to life, and withered souls be quickened by the Infinite Spirit. Make haste, O my brother, that while there is yet time, our lips may taste of the immortal draught. For the breeze of life, now blowing from the city of the well-beloved, cannot last, and the streaming river of holy utterance must needs be stilled, and the portals of the Rizwan cannot forever remain open. The day will surely come when the nightingale of paradise will have winged its flight away from its earthly abode unto its heavenly nest. Then will its melody be heard no more, and the beauty of the rose cease to shine. Seize the time, therefore, ere the glory of the divine springtime hath spent itself, and the bird of eternity cease to warble its melody, that thy inner hearing may not be deprived of hearkening unto its call. This is my counsel unto thee and unto the beloved of God. Whosoever wisheth, let him turn aside thereunto, let him turn thereunto, and whosoever wisheth, let him turn away. God verily is independent of him and of that which he may see and witness. It's very, again, very clear allusion to Baha'u'llah's own station here in this passage. It echoes the Persian hidden word,